is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Dan Hurley. While in college, Adi Jaffe began using and dealing drugs, which eventually resulted in his arrest and a year-long prison sentence. While in prison, he began to rebuild his life. Upon release, he went back to school and earned his PhD in psychology from UCLA. Today, Dr. Jaffe is CEO of Ignited LLC and a nationally recognized expert on mental health, addiction, and the stigma of those. His work focuses on changing the way we think about and deal with addiction and reducing the stigma often associated with mental illness. Dr. Jaffe is in Cincinnati to speak this evening at a forum entitled Addiction, Shedding the Shame and Stigma, sponsored by the Jewish Family Services, and will be at Cooper Creek Event Center in Blue Ash. He joins us this afternoon to discuss removing the shame and stigma of addiction. You can join our conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome to Cincinnati. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. It's my first time in the city. I love being here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you're from that little place out on the West Coast someplace.
You might have heard about it. Place where all the hippies go, Los Angeles.
I thought that was San Francisco. So, anyway, one of the things that we have been, you've been listening in on the first part of our show, when you were in recovery, I've read enough about your story and listened to some TEDx talks that you say that the most important moment was when you failed in a recovery situation and had to face up to that.
Yeah, and I heard you bringing up relapse in the last section, so I love this part of it. I look at relapse completely differently than a lot of other people do, and I look at relapse as an opportunity, which is one of the things that I don't like about the fact that we punish people for relapsing. So the story that you're referring to is I was kicked out of rehab for using, and I'd been using for about a month before they caught me, and I'd been there for 3 months. And I was, if anybody knows my story, I was struggling with really severe drug addiction. It was methamphetamine at the time, but there were a lot of consequences. It's not like I hadn't realized that things were serious at that point. But I started using. I relapsed. And they caught me and they kicked me out. And in the very typical vein of what was happening in my life up to that point, I was already with a whole stack of lies of how I was going to tell my – I was 25 years old, so what I was going to tell my parents to get out of it and all these things. And I had a phone call with my dad, and I was ready. I was in the middle of starting to tell him the story, and something landed for me. And I said, you know, I'm just going to try to tell him the truth. And look, honestly, part of the reason is – they had already learned so many of the things that had been wrong in my life that I hadn't been honest with.
Your parents had learned.
My parents, yeah. And for the 3 months before that. And all of a sudden, I realized I had a choice between allowing the truth to keep being the thing that guides me or starting to lie again and then having to compound these lies as I had done for decades. And in that moment, I accepted something in myself, which was partially how terribly addicted I was, right? How bad of a problem I had created for myself. But it was through my own experience that I had to come to that place. And so for me, and I tell this to all the people I work with now, relapses are opportunities. Don't look at them as a failure at all. And if you look at successes in life in general, I mean, the biggest successes, right? The Thomas Edisons, the Michael Jordans, the Lincolns of the world, the J.K. Rowlings, like, they became successes through repeated meetings with failure. And in addiction, somehow we've gotten to this place where if you fail, I mean, you know, the people who just visited with you, they only kick somebody out for 7 days. I was kicked out for 30 days. And the expectation is then go take care of yourself. And if you can take care of yourself for this period of time, we'll take you back. And I think that's a mistake.
Well, it's sort of this failure question and opportunity. In Silicon Valley, I think the phrase is just fail faster. Find out what doesn't work and move on to whatever the next thing. Now, that's an innovation, but this is about personal growth. And some of the terminology I've seen you use is the whole question about hiding.
Yeah.
And is another way of talking about being honest with yourself or being honest with others. But the opposite of that is hiding, not only from others, but probably from yourself, right?
And this came up for me all over the last segment. And it's I have nothing against 12-step-based traditional recovery, but what I have something against is that that is the only option many people encounter. And that's okay as long as we keep working on expanding the options because, you know, your previous guest mentioned that they greatly increase outcomes for people who come after rehab, and that is wonderful. But the unfortunate reality in our country is that only about 10% of people with addiction problems, and the number is about 25 to 30 million people who struggle, only 10% seek treatment. And if only 10% of people are seeking treatment, that's not about the addicts. That's about the treatment that's being offered. You know, what I like to kind of say in today's talk or in the training I give tomorrow is if people are not taking the medicine, you can blame them for not taking the medicine all you want, or you can create a new medicine, right? And we are in the situation where for decades now, we have been fighting about why are addicts not participating in what we're offering. My approach is completely different, and I'm not the only one doing this, but my approach is let's start offering them options they want to take.
So what's the essential difference here between 12-step and the alternative as you see it?
So there are a slew of options, and there's actually my a partner in a rehab I used to run is a native of Cincinnati, Dr. Mark Curran, so I'll give him a shout out here because he'll enjoy that. But there are a lot of people who study this sort of work. And, you know, you talked about medications. A caller talked about medications. The fact that most recovery-oriented rehabs and or sober livings or continued care sort of facilities like the ones that you had just hosted don't accept people who are on medications. And they got away from that question about antidepressants a little bit, but what I got from their answer is no, we do not take people on antidepressants. We know that about 60% of people who struggle with addiction issues also struggle with co-occurring mental health. And to tell them that you're going to withhold treatment that is otherwise fully accepted in society as being non-addictive and helpful, to me, begs the question of why, right? What is it about addicts that we think is so different? And that's where I think we get to that question of shame and hiding that you were talking about. I think that one of the primary problems we have right now is we see addicts as ongoing liars who are unable to think for themselves and can't get better. And so we believe that we have to create this complete scaffolding around them. We have to hold them like babies. If we created instead a completely different system, which asked of a person who's struggling, whether it's opiates or alcohol, because they're right, alcohol is still one of our biggest problems. But we walk up to them and we say, look, your drinking or your drug use is a problem. We have a menu of options. You really should consider partaking in one of these things rather than saying to them, you have to quit everything forever and you've got to go to 12-step meetings and you can't take any medication for anything else you're struggling with. That situation is so different. The setup that we have is giving people back agency, allowing the people who are struggling to understand, yes, I have a problem, but I get to choose how I fix it. And what I've found when I address people this way, resistance to treatment essentially completely goes away.
Because there's multiple paths inside that treatment.
And they get to choose. I've never met a single person who struggles with addiction who does not recognize that they have a problem. And I think that's we tell ourselves that story all the time, that people are in denial. They're not in denial of the fact that they have an issue. They're in denial of the fact that lifelong abstinence is the solution. Mm-hmm. And my urging is let's stop fighting them on that and let's start offering them other solutions. Like those medications that we discussed, right? Methadone, Suboxone, all those things. They work to keep people off of opiates. So why are we not allowing it? Do we want them to be on it lifelong? Maybe not. But is that really for us to start mandating right now?
We have a call, caller, Tom, yeah, who is calling in, and I think his comment or question relates to what we're talking about right now. So, Tom, do you have a question?
Hi, yes. I just have a compliment, I guess, for your guest, because I listened to the last segment. I've lost 3 brothers in the last 6 years to drug overdose and spent 25 years in and out of prison with them trying to not me and visiting them and trying to keep them straight, practicing tough love, going to AA, going to Al-Anon. And the last segment really upset me because I'm obviously still grieving, but it is so nice to hear that you need to be held like a baby rather than shaming and trying to force them into recovery. I'm on Suboxone, but I'm on it for off-label use. I was a gymnast, and I broke my I'm missing my right heel, and I broke my back three places. Oof. And I was put on it 13 years ago. And there's such a stigma there. I can't let anybody know I'm on it because they'll think I'm a junkie automatically. But it was a miracle for my brother. For a year, he was totally sober, didn't want nothing to do with heroin. And the insurance cut him off. And he wasn't able to meet his next doctor's appointment. And he died of a heroin overdose downtown at a homeless shelter. And it was just horrible to see him go that way.
Tom, we can
so
clearly...
I applaud you. I applaud your guest for his approach because I think that heals more people.
We can really hear the pain in your voice.
Absolutely.
Let's let Dr. Jaffe sort of respond to that. Thank you for calling, in your case, calling back. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for calling, and I heard your call before. And I mean, honestly, it's the pain in your voice and the pain that I see in people who have been in and out of rehab 4, 5, 12 times, families that have spent $250,000 on trying to get help and are running into the same wall over and over. That is the reason why I do what I do is we need other options. You know, we can keep trying to refine the machine that only the refine the treatment that only 10% of people want to engage in, or we can start trying to offer options that 50, 70, 80% of people want to take part in. And we will save tens of thousands of lives a year if we just change our approach and stop believing that this all-in abstinence-only approach for life is even the goal for everybody. It's just not the goal for everybody in the world, and we need to accept that. It's not our lives.
Tom used a term that, you know, he was on Suboxone, but he couldn't let anybody know because of the stigma. And what you're talking about this evening at Cooper Creek is shedding the shame and stigma. Talk a little bit about how those things, who's carrying those around and how that functions in this whole situation.
Sure. So stigma is the meaning we attribute to individuals that have specific conditions, right? So a stigmatized condition, we have specific opinions, specific notions about those individuals. That's what Tom is talking about. If somebody thinks or somebody knows that I take this medication, they'll think I'm a heroin junkie because that's what they've learned to associate with that, even though Suboxone is also a pain medication. The shame that comes along is the feeling that people typically feel when they're stigmatized. And what I'm going to talk about tonight, and I can just allude to a little bit here today, is there is a huge body of literature that has proven to us over time that when people are shamed, when people are stigmatized, they act in ways that correspond to that negative attitude that people have about them. They actually fall more in line with the negative expectations that other people have of them. And what I'm saying in saying this is literally the fact that we don't believe that addicts have the power to support themselves or that addicts are so weak and that they are liars. Our beliefs about that make it more likely not only that the addicts will behave in these ways, but also through something called confirmation bias, that we will only see the behaviors that they engage in that support our view. It's like, you know, if you've got two kids at home and one of them is the good kid and the other is the bad kid, when the good kid does something mean, you brush it off because they're the good kid. It was a one-off. When the bad kid does something good, you don't pay attention to it. And they both struggle with that, right? We do this to addicts on a daily basis, and we have to stop because people are dying partially because of the attitudes, because of the stigma that we attribute to them.
Well, something very interesting is happening here. Dr. Will Sawyer has called back. This is the second time we've gotten a call back. And
love it.
Dr. Sawyer, yes, I love this too. What's your observation at this point?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So thank you for saying what you're saying. My question is, since addiction's a human disease, and if we're really interested in harm reduction, my question is, why don't they allow personal physicians to prescribe methadone as a long-term treatment for addiction instead of the embarrassment and the expense of going to a methadone clinic for folks who may not have the funds anyway, but also they do need a relationship for anxiety and depression in a, quote, medical home? I think we should do it slightly differently.
Yeah.
I wanted your thoughts about that.
Yeah, so, you know, look, as far as I'm concerned, I think all options should be on the table at all times. You need to have the right staffing in order to make sure that, you know, the treatment you're the treatment that you're engaging in is provided by the right provider. That's part of the reason why sober livings, for instance, don't even provide treatment. They provide safe living conditions. But, you know, Doctor, you asked earlier about antidepressants, and there are a slew of appropriate medications and other treatments that can be provided by psychologists or, we do biofeedback and neurofeedback sometimes for some clients, et cetera, things that can help people with these conditions. You know the reason why people are not being given doses for long term, and that is because the notion is if I give you doses long term, you will divert them, you will give them to other people, you use them inappropriately. Now, just to be clear, that is sometimes true. So it's not that if you give somebody a month worth of methadone, they will never divert it. They will. But the problem is we've been given, in my opinion, a false dichotomous choice. And the dichotomous choice is between providing people treatment that works and keeps them abstinent and safe for the rest of their lives or allowing them to do whatever they want and killing them. That's what we keep being told that we're being provided. But that's not the reality because the way we've been going is killing more.
Right. And I hope that people will pick up on that and at Cooper Creek. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Joss Elstrow. And we had some help from Jim Nolan. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.